Got an email last week from one of our members. It simply stated that their favorite verse was in James 1:17. And they were looking forward to the message that would include that verse. And that's all it said. Just a word of encouragement about a favorite verse. Well, that kind of personalizes things for me, but it also adds some pressure, you know. So if you're going to do that all the time, that I mean, it's almost like saying, this is my favorite verse, don't mess it up. And so that is not at all what was being said, but it made me think about it more deeply and to consider why that verse, because I didn't ask, was this person's favorite and one that stood out among all of the wonderful words that we have from God. Well, I think when we look at it in greater detail and more depth, it becomes clear that this is a pretty incredible passage of Scripture and one that deserves our highest attention because it speaks of the purpose, the goodness, the glory, the generosity and the confidence that is engendered in all of us toward God. The attention really is less on us and a great deal more on Him. And when that happens, that elevates everybody. And so the more that we glorify and lift up the name of God, the more that we glorify and lift up the name of Jesus, the more we experience that glory in and of ourselves. This is a very positive message, which is something that is sometimes hard to find in the book of James because he's confronting so many of our issues that a lot of times we just feel almost set upon. James has already helped us in chapter 1 to understand the reality of testing and trials and the attitude of believers that should be present during those times of struggle, being one of joy as we learn to trust God. But he also understood that we are limited and weak, and so he said, you're going to need additional wisdom that comes not from yourself or your surroundings, but from God himself. And so he says, ask God, and he'll give you wisdom to know how to have that joyful attitude toward the trials of various kinds in this life. But he said, be careful. Because a lot of times the kind of things that come up in these trials separate us and we tend to withdraw into the groups that we have assigned ourselves to, whether it's rich or poor or whether it's this particular social setting or status or another. And he said that is not the way God works. God deals with all of us equally and we have to understand that regardless of what background or experience we're coming from, the focus and attention has to be on God. For the poor man, he finds glory in the great gift of salvation. For the person of means, he finds humility, recognizing that those things are temporary and earthly, and our greatest hope is in Jesus. But then he says, you need to be warned. Some of you have faced these trials, and you have yielded to them in a way that has turned toward your own selfish desire. And now, in your guilt, you're trying to blame God for your temptation. And that's simply not true. Temptation doesn't come from God, for he is neither tempted by that which is evil, nor does he use evil to lead anyone astray. And so he's drawing us to a greater understanding of confidence. There are some things that need to be in place inside your head and your heart as you move into every single day of your life. If those things are not firmly placed, then the challenges of this life put us in a position of danger to have them altered or unseated so that we are literally unmoored from the tether that we have by God's grace to his faithfulness. I was teaching the men's Bible study, which, by the way, Wednesday morning, we had 50 in attendance. That's the highest attendance we've had since we started back in May after the shutdown that happened in late March and April. And had an additional 10 that were in Facebook Live throughout the whole time. And then I don't know how to make sense of all the metrics that I get from Facebook, but 36 were viewing the video, but I don't think all of them viewed all of the video. I just don't know how to know that. And so I'm told that Facebook certainly is invasive in its infringement on our privacy, but if that's true, they don't give me that information. So anyway, good group, and I'm just plugging the men's Bible study. But in the men's Bible study, I'm teaching through the book of Romans. And so in Romans, passage that we were studying Wednesday morning, I was working on that, and every once in a while you get a sentence or a paragraph that you feel is particularly inspired and something that really resonates in your mind that's kind of the end result of study that you've done. Let me read you the sentence because it applies to James in the passage we're studying today. Here's the sentence that I gave them. The goodness and faithfulness of God must always remain a fixed point of reference by which we align all belief and behavior. The goodness and faithfulness of God must be a fixed point of reference. It means this isn't open for discussion. It isn't open for debate. It isn't something that the circumstances of life bring any alteration to. My confidence and faith in God and in His goodness is true. And if I don't understand the circumstance, or if I am drawn to frustration or anger directed toward God because I think He's being unfair or He has somehow changed the way He deals with me, I need to come back to that which I know and set aside for a moment that which I am feeling. Feelings, emotions, must not inform our understanding, but rather the opposite has to be true. Our understanding of what is true must inform how we feel. The goodness and faithfulness of God, then, as a fixed point of reference, determines how we believe about the world around us and the experiences we encounter, but it also determines how we behave in that relationship with God. So as we look at James chapter 1 and verses 16 through 18 today, we do so in order to further build upon our understanding of the goodness of God. I said last week as we were talking about temptation and the desires of the flesh and things of that nature, I said then, quoting a statement that I picked up from Craig actually, and in that statement I said that whenever we choose to pursue our own evil desire at the expense of faithfulness and obedience to God, we are doubting in that moment the goodness of God, the character of God. Now what I mean by that and what I said in reference to that is that in those moments where we look at something that we desire but is in conflict with what God has said, what we are doing if we yield to the desire is saying that what I want and what I desire for my flesh is better than what God wants for me. We need to be really careful about that. And so rather than trying to alter all of the little behavioral issues that you and I contend with every day, the solution is found in a much broader treatment of the matter. And that is, rather than focusing on me, focusing me on Him, the goodness of God. So that's what we'll do today. We'll look at the goodness of God. Three different things, beginning with verse 16, that we can understand. First of them, the ways of God. He says, do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. And you say, now how are you going to get a whole point out of that verse? Well, I think I have proven my ability already to get the most out of a text in that we are now, I'm being ridiculed in the office on a weekly basis that it's going to take me a year and a half to preach through the book of James. That is not true. It won't take that long, but it's going to take longer than we may have thought at the first analysis of that. As we look at this passage, though, there's something key to our understanding. Verse 16 is a transition. And so that means that it is transitioning from what is said in verse 15. And in the section, verse 15 is included in that I preached from last week. That's the section dealing with temptation and evil desire. So he's transitioning from that to the goodness of God. Why is this important? It's important because the two are directly and immediately connected in a way that's undeniable. And if you don't understand one, you can't understand the other. If you get caught up in temptation and your struggles or God's blame or those kinds of things, then you lose complete sight of the solution. As I said before, the solution is our fixed belief in the goodness of God. If we lose sight of that, then we are going to find ourselves swirling in this messed up deal where we are constantly being tossed in one direction or another based on what we're experiencing either emotionally or with regard to evil desire. So this is an important transitional statement that is showing us very specific steps that lead to a better way, and that way is found in God. So he says, do not be deceived. Deception is something that is a challenge for all of us. The complexity of temptation and sin in the Christian life requires a warning against self-deception. If the great temptation of the sinner is unbelief, then the great temptation of the believer is misbelief. It's not that you don't believe, it is that you are believing wrongly. The believer may have an immature faith in Christ, but oftentimes can adopt falsehoods about the life of faith. Some of James' audience believed that God was to blame for their temptation and subsequent failure that led to their sin. And yet, in no case can a role ever be assigned to God in relation to evil, temptation, or sin. If those things are at issue, that is 100% on us, and none of it is on him. James implores the believers then with strong statements, and he uses one here when he says, do not be deceived, and it's a very strong and emphatic statement encouraging us not to yield to the lies of evil. On the other hand, he draws us in because he calls the hearers beloved brothers, identifying himself with us, so that his strongest appeal is based on this use of the term beloved brothers, that believers must hold to an unwavering trust in God, but we do so best when we do it together. To do that, we must all be on guard against self-deception. What self-deception does is try to force us into darkness. What truth does is bring us into light. We have grown too accustomed to darkness. Now, why is that? And this is, by the way, not really part of the sermon, so this is the bonus section of our time together today. Why is it that we're drawn to darkness? There are several reasons. One, it appeals to something inside of us, and we can participate in it without anybody else knowing, at least for a time, and we can have the appearance of faithfulness, but also the indulgence of evil. Living in darkness lets you have your cake and eat it too. Now the problem is it's still a lie, and it's still darkness, and it's still destructive. I heard that whatever you eat on Super Bowl Sunday doesn't count as far as the calories are concerned. That's another example of self-deception. Perhaps a relatively harmless one, but nonetheless the same principle. Self-deception is prevalent because we've grown accustomed to the darkness, because it feeds our desire for something that is generally with evil or at the very least earthly intent, while allowing us to maintain an appearance of righteousness. There is another word for that. It's called hypocrite. But it is something that is so common that we all can identify with it. There's another reason that we have grown accustomed to darkness. Many times it's just not safe in the light. You say, well, this is a safe place, is it? Now, those of you who've been around church folk for a long time know that Christians are among the few who shoot their wounded. You say, well, that's not how I feel. It may not be, but it's what happens. We're not very good at extending the grace that we claim. We can be pretty good at judgmentalism and ostracizing those who disagree. But we struggle many times when it comes to extending grace. And I realize it's a complex and difficult issue. That's why, in order for us to cope with it, there needs to be a safe place for transparency, for confession, for dealing with the challenges of this life. The more we withdraw, the wider the walls are constructed, the more people retreat to the darkness and simply hide what is wrong until it becomes no longer something that can be hidden at all. I don't have a solution, and I don't mean to be condemning. I'm simply observing what I know and what you probably can attest to as well. These are areas in which we can stand here and I can proclaim the need for truth and transparency, and I can say that we need to be people of light and we need to be committed to helping others come out of that darkness, and yet at the same time we've got to recognize we've got some work to do in this arena. If we are going to overcome those things that would cause people to retreat to such matters, it means that we're going to have some hard conversations that are going to be incredibly uncomfortable. And I just don't know that we have the maturity for that. So there's a reason why darkness is something that we are drawn to. It allows us to maintain a double standard and a double life. And give the right appearance, and we do it because we just don't feel like it's safe to do otherwise. And so there's a there are some issues there. Are there other things? Sure. This is not an exhaustive treatment of the subject. Remember, this is bonus material, and so anything you get from this is on top of what else you're getting. So pause and consider as you think about what he is telling us and as he is reminding us not to be deceived and encouraging us from the perspective of the relationship that we have with one another to understand that living in the light is not an easy thing, and overcoming the evil desire that is within us all and the temptation to sin that presents is not an easy thing. Being people who are connected and committed to the goodness of God is what he is setting up for us, but that's not an easy thing. And so the idea that all of this stuff just happens automatically is unrealistic at the very least. The ways of God are different than ours. And the complexity associated with the issues that we deal with as a result of sin and the complexity of finding ways through that darkness to the light that is only in Jesus Christ is just not always as simple as we sometimes make it out to be. So to do what we all must do and to become the people that God is calling us to be, we must be on guard against self-deception. God is just in sending trials that test us, but he does that always for the good of his purpose and his glory. It must never be viewed as a temptation that leads us to sin. When that happens, it is born out of our own evil desire. The ways of God are absolutely and unapproachably linked to the goodness of God. And the goodness of God is unalterable and does not change simply because of a perspective that we may bring to it or a circumstance we may go through. So as he transitions us to what he's going to tell us now, verse 16 provides that transition by drawing us back to the ways of God so that we are not deceived by the ways of evil desire. Verse 17 then shows us the work of God. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. The work of God, he describes for us in very vivid terminology in verse 17. He says that every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. What's the difference between a good gift and a perfect gift? Well, there really is no difference. They are synonyms of one another and just different ways of saying the same thing in order to add emphasis to it. However, there is a slight difference in some of the other details of the words that are used here that would give us a little more insight. Every good gift speaks of the goodness of what is given. It talks about the gift itself. And it does so in a way that seems to lend credence to our understanding that the good gift he is speaking of is the gift of salvation. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. So it's a gift that we have received. And it talks about the goodness and the perfection and the glory and all of the things that are associated with this as not just a good gift, but the very best. And it is from that relationship that is established through faith in Jesus Christ that we are brought into that arena of the goodness of this gift, and we understand just how good it is, so that we now begin to understand what Jesus was teaching when he spoke of the pearl of great price, or when he talked about those things which are of this earth being transitory, but the one thing that is worth everything is being eternal. So the goodness of God and the goodness of the gift that we have in Jesus Christ is what he's talking about here, and it focuses our attention on the quality of all that God has provided. Perfect gift, though, also has a slight nuance to that word that makes it sound very much like the first, but now the focus is a bit more on the giver than the gift. For only a perfect God could give a perfect gift. Have you ever wanted to give that perfect gift? You know, you work at it, you try, and you do everything that you think you need to do. You're creative and sensitive and whatever. And maybe once or twice in your lifetime it actually works out like that. And you get the expected reaction that you were hoping for. Problem is that we're trying to focus attention on a thing, and none of us really want things. What we want more than anything are those relationships. The relationship is what matters most. And so the good gift and the perfect gift is going to have less to do with the gift in this description and more to do with the giver. So that we understand that even while we were sinners, Christ died for us. God loved us so much that in spite of our sinfulness, in spite of our disobedience, he gave the perfect gift, because he's the perfect giver. Everything with God as its source is good. The gifts of God reflect the character of God. They never foster evil desire or sin. The gifts of God are perfect because they are the fulfillment of his will for his people. So that when we see that every good and perfect gift is coming from God, we understand that what makes the gift good is the good giver. Everything comes from God. Everything good comes from the goodness of God. God's goodness has provided the created world as a general gift to all people. But his perfect gifts are given to all who put their trust in him and who seek his wisdom. And so it is faith that brings us into that personal relationship with God, that moves us beyond just the awareness of the goodness of a world around us that we rely upon, but now it brings us into a personal relationship so that we experience him through his indwelling presence in your life. God is the Father of lights. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights. God is the Father of lights, meaning he's the originator and the ruler of all things. What are the lights that he's talking about? He's talking about the celestial bodies. He's talking about what you see when you look into the heavens at night. He's talking about him as the creator of the universe, and this expanse of the lights above us is something that enables us to understand that. His good gifts come from above so that their goodness is intrinsic to them. They originate with him. They come from the realm of his presence. Therefore, they are always good. Good gifts do not come from below. What happens below? Below is where they are misused because of evil desire that he spoke of in the previous verses. But they come from above where there is no such thing. Thus, nothing that is withheld from God's children or forbidden in God's word is good, regardless of its enticement to desire. He says in the latter part of verse 17, every good gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. God does not change. The Father of lights has created the celestial bodies that move and change and thereby usher in the seasons, the days, and the years. But he is above them and remains unaffected by them, so that he himself never changes. While we struggle with the trials that come in the seasons of life, he calls us to himself with wisdom that guides everything to its fulfillment according to his divine plan. One of the things that we often do is we talk about how we don't like change and how it disrupts our sense of security or identity. And so we complain about it and we declare that we're going to not change. And yet, that's an impossibility because everything is changing. Everything is in the process of change. And not all of those changes are necessarily what we would consider for the better. And it's because of the way we think and the things that we want, we are often incapable, it seems, of appreciating or accepting the seasons of life. I had the question asked of me many years ago. It isn't asked anymore, but it was then. If my intentions in the course of life would ever be to return to where I grew up, that is, go back to Texas. And I hadn't thought about it because I just didn't have that intention. I never had that intention. But when it really became interesting to me was when I had gone back for a visit, and one of the people I grew up with said, "Well, have you ever considered moving back?" I said, "No, I haven't." "Well, didn't you like it better here than in Missouri?" And I said, "No, I don't." And I didn't. I said, I liked it great while I was here. It was a great place to grow up, and I loved the life that we had, and I'm grateful for it. But to say that it was better than the life I have now, where I live now, is not correct at all. "Well, what do you like so much about Missouri?" I said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing that I like that I never got here. I like the change of seasons." Seasons change in Texas too. It goes from being like blistering hot to frigidly cold and then back to blistering hot. And there was no fall. Now the leaves would turn and they would drop off, but when it's 88 degrees outside in November, that doesn't feel like fall. I didn't like that. I liked the change of the seasons. I still like it. I didn't like not having snow ever. Now, I will admit that I don't like snow as much now as I once did. I used to really think that was great. Now, it's just a hassle because it always comes on Saturday. And so I don't know why that is, but for the last few years, it seems like if we're going to get snow around here, we're going to get it on Wednesday, or we're going to get it on Saturday, and it's going to disrupt what we do on Sunday. But I like that. Change is good. Change is reality. You can resist it, and you can deny it, and you can live in some sort of self-imposed bubble of sameness if you want. But the reality is you're still changing. You're becoming grumpier, and you're becoming more difficult to contend with, and you're becoming more alone. Embrace it. Why? Because what you're really wanting is security and identity. And you can't find that in things you don't control. And you don't control your circumstances, and you can't control the movement of those celestial bodies that are marking the process of your life. But if what you really want is security and identity, there is a place you can find it. You can find it in the Father of lights, with whom there is no change. You can find it in the one who never has a shadow that is cast, because there is no movement or effect of the things that affect us on him. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. If the goodness of God was apparent to you in the moment of your expression of faith, in the moment of your salvation experience, in the moment of that time when you chose him at all cost above everything else, if the goodness of God was true then, it is absolutely true now. When the circumstances change, he doesn't. He's still just as strong as he's always been. He's still just as good as he's always been. He still loves you just as much as he always has. He's still working through you for his own purpose and glory, which elevates you and allows you to share in something that has eternal significance and value. The circumstances and the trials of this life challenge us, but they challenge us to trust in that which is always true, that fixed point of reference, found only in the goodness of God. The work of God. Thirdly, the will of God. Verse 18. Verse 18 says, of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creation. So the will of God is revealing, so that as we see, we choose not to be deceived, not to believe that he is the author of temptation or evil. In verse 17, we recognize that all the goodness of this life comes from him, and everything that we truly need and desire at that deepest level of truth is found only in him, that he is not only worthy of our trust, but he has proven that he is faithful. So that of his own will now, what has he done? He has brought us forth by the word of truth. God has birthed new life into his chosen ones by virtue of the working of his perfect will. The will of God leads us to this new birth, being born again. The new birth of life and the work of God stands in stark contrast. Again, the verses that we just read, what happens when sin reaches its apex? It gives birth to death. But on the other hand, what God has done by his will and by his grace is to give birth. He has brought us forth. That's what that means. It means to birth into existence. He has birthed us to life by the word of truth. It is God's will that you would experience new birth. God gives birth to believers by the means of his truthful word. The word of truth is virtually synonymous with the gospel and is the instrument by which God implants new life in the believer. Have you ever considered that everything that God does, he does by his word? Everything. From the beginning, when he created everything, he spoke it into creation. When he sent his son, the word came to dwell among us. The word of God. He is the all-inclusive statement of who God is for us to know. The word of truth is the Bible, so that he has provided for us in his word everything that is necessary. In previous times, he spoke to us through the prophets and through all manner of different expressions, but now he has spoken by his word. This is the final authority. This is the conclusion of it all. So that everything that you need to know, you can know through the word of truth. And the word of truth is everything that we can know that we should know. So his will is that we would experience new life. We experience new life through obedience to his word as given to us both in the Son as well as in the written text. So that the word of truth by which God gives birth to new creatures produces a harvest that he had intended since the moment of his first creating. That's what he means when he says that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. He has given us new life, to made us new creatures, so that produces a harvest which has been intended from the beginning. Indeed, those that are saved out of lost humanity become the first fruits of God's saving work that ultimately will reach every component of creation. Now, what I mean by that and what the word first fruits is helping us to understand is it's an Old Testament term, and it refers back to the harvest season, so that when the harvest was brought in, the very first of that harvest, the first fruits that were gathered, were then devoted to God. They were given to him as a gift. Not so much as a sacrifice, as a gift of acknowledgement. That everything else that they were going to keep and utilize for their own lives was from him as well. But this portion was given to him. Not the least, not the leftover, not the last, the first fruits, the best. Being devoted to God meant that they had no other purpose, they had no other reason other than to serve his glory and as an acknowledgement of thankfulness to his provision. When he says that about believers, about Christians, that because of the new birth that he has wrought in us, we are becoming that first fruit set apart for those who come after, the representative, the best portion for his glory, for his purpose. And that purpose serves to declare to all of creation what is coming. Because of the redemption that God is going to ultimately finalize in the lives of his children, he will also redeem all of the brokenness of this created order. So that what he is describing here when he speaks of you and me and the expression of faith, when we give our lives to Jesus and when we accept Jesus as the ultimate gift of life from God, and we identify our lives with Jesus through baptism, and we live our lives in obedience to Christ for his glory, we are the first fruits of the evidence of God's ability to redeem that which sin had previously claimed. And it becomes the example of how he will redeem everything else. Why do we have a pandemic? Because we live in a sinful world where disease runs rampant. Why do we have social injustice? Because we are sinful people who seek our own desires above that of others. Why do we have a world that is oftentimes described as an ecological disaster? Because it was never meant to last forever, and we do what serves us, regardless of the cost. Over and over, you can come up with every problem of the world, every problem of your own life, every issue that you deal with that causes you pain or loss or some sort of limitation or creates in you an insecurity or fear. And you will discover that in each one of those things, all of it can be traced directly back to the sinfulness that entered this world and has continued to grow exponentially with each passing moment. The solution is not in fixing all of the individual problems that we can identify, not that we shouldn't try. The solution ultimately is found in the redemption of that which is broken and damaged. Your faith in Jesus Christ serves as the first evidence of His goodness and His promise to redeem everything. So that with what we have at our disposal right now, even with all of its challenges and troubles, we can declare that God is so good. Life may be hard. You may even call it bad. But that in no wise takes anything away from the fact that God is so good. One day He's going to fix it all. One day, it's all going to come to a conclusion. Until that day, you and I can face the various trials with joy in our hearts, refusing to yield to the desire for evil and temptation, and fixing our commitment to the goodness of God.